Welcome back to Class Act, Updates in Education Law. I'm Miriam.
I'm Lisa.
We're attorneys at Walter Haverfield in Ohio. We practice school law. Every few weeks we get together, we talk about the most recent legal developments in education that are relevant to boards, administrators, teachers, anybody who works with the kids in our schools. We've had Peter here for an interesting discussion on technological developments and how they affect school districts. Today, we're switching gears and we'll be talking a little bit about booster groups, parent organizations, and other third-party school support groups. Student activities are increasingly expensive and districts can be cash-strapped, so these groups can be very effective and helpful at raising money to offset activity costs. At the same time, as Peter will share with us, booster group misconduct gets a good number of headlines, even though many people probably don't know much about these booster groups and the various regulations that they are required to conform to. Peter's back with us today to talk about these booster groups and explain some of the legal issues that districts should be aware of. Welcome back, Peter.
Thank you. It's good to be back, truly.
Hi, Peter. So why don't we just dive right into explain what booster groups are, how they function in a typical school district, kind of start with the background piece.
The booster groups are typically organizations that are organized by parents who have a strong affiliation with the school. You know, they're there to support drama, to support sports, maybe a particular sport, maybe the athletic department in general. It really depends on what the parents want to do, but they're not part of the district, and they shouldn't be a part of the district. Because they're not part of the district, they don't really have any accountability, and that's the problem. So when there's booster groups that are doing their own thing without any sort of control or regulation or structure, then they can abuse the system to suit their own ends.
So because these booster groups aren't part of the school district, they don't have to follow the school district's policies, all these laws we talk about in all our episodes that school districts have to follow. They're kind of their own separate entity.
There are times when they will agree. There'll be a written agreement to follow the board's policies, but they don't have to. In general, a booster group isn't legally obligated to follow the policies of the district. If there's a good relationship between the board and the booster groups, then oftentimes the booster groups will have no problem complying.
Okay, so is it going to make a difference in any type of analysis of their activities, whether or not they are a nonprofit organization or are more of an informal group?
Well, it does if they want to fundraise, and that's typically why the booster group has organized anyway, is to fundraise. So the incentive to generate money is that whoever donates can then deduct that donation for tax purposes.
Oh.
So it's key that the booster group does become a 501c3 organization. They file the proper paperwork with the IRS. My understanding is it's not too involved at all. And then they get the letter back from the IRS saying you're officially 501c3. Now you can go fundraise.
So that basically just means they're registered as a nonprofit organization.
Correct.
And who's responsible just to oversee that and make sure that, you know, they comply with all the initial filings? Is that a board member's job?
No, it's not the board member's job. It's not the treasurer's job. It's a good idea that the treasurer somehow get confirmation that the booster group is 501c3 compliant, just so they have that knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if it turns out that this booster group doesn't have 501c3 yet, it's accepting all these donations and people are trying to deduct these taxes and the district's name is included in various correspondences and notices and fundraising activities, then it can be problematic from a PR standpoint.
So then is it also going to make any difference if that group is officially recognized by the school district and board or if they're not?
Peter, can you explain the difference between officially recognized groups and non-recognized groups or informal
officially
groups?
Recognized groups would have approval from the board. They would pass a resolution saying this is an official booster group that supports this particular activity.
And so the district's basically, or the board is basically saying we acknowledge and accept associated with the district.
And typically they would go beyond just acknowledging them. They would also consent to the booster group's use of the school district's name, the mascot. These mm-hmm. booster groups want to use the school colors and the
logos.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. The motto of the mm-hmm. district. And so when the group is officially recognized, the board would grant consent to use those items. And then in exchange, the board would try to get some promises from the booster groups indicating, say, that they'll comply with the board's policies or the volunteers will be background checked.
So agreement between the board and the group really sounds like a pretty
important piece of
it's an important piece, not legally required. It depends on the district whether they want to do that, but it can be quite helpful.
You could see benefits really for both parties.
Absolutely. I mean, it could give the board an opportunity to have somebody in attendance at the booster group meetings or mm-hmm. ensure that if they wanted, the board treasurer can have access to the financial books of the booster group. It could all be in that agreement, and then that agreement be adopted at a board meeting.
So, okay, so then what if a booster group doesn't want to do this and they just want to remain unofficial?
Then they're treated like any other outside organization, which includes Boy Scouts or 4-H clubs, MAD organizations, any community organization, mm-hmm. and they don't have that preferential treatment. So they would have to get in line to have access to school facilities, for example. They wouldn't have a right to use the school's name or the mascots in their flyers or in their fundraising activities.
Between being official or not, and whether the district should recognize a specific group, are there any really specific advantages, disadvantages, one way or the other?
It's all personal preference. It'd be nice. The advantage for not being recognized is if the booster group does end up going its own way and conducts activities that the board doesn't approve of, then the board can distance itself more from the activities of that booster group.
So is there a way that the district should deal with setting what expectations it might have for these kind of groups?
So at a minimum, they should at least have a policy in place. So you might not have that agreement with that school support entity or the booster group, mm-hmm. but at least you have a policy setting forth your expectations. And
so a policy, the booster group wouldn't have input necessarily on. I mean, policies are adopted and developed just by the Board of
Education.
Board
itself, right. The school administrators would advise the board possibly of the content of the policy, but ultimately it's the board's policy.
And what kind of, typically, I guess, Peter, what would you say? What kind of provisions are included in a board policy about a booster group?
Well, some of the big ones are requirement that the booster group be insured and not have students at certain activities, especially those activities have alcohol or gambling.
Okay.
Maybe there's just a blanket, a no for any fundraising activity that involves gambling or alcohol. You know, mm-hmm. those two things come with a social stigma, and not every district is comfortable being affiliated with a gambling event or any sort of event that alcohol is served at.
Sure, I guess it depends on your community, really.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It does.
So since the booster group isn't part of this policy making, they're not agreeing to these things, how does the board go about really kind of enforcing the preferences? So say you put in a provision about fundraising activities, what kind of leverage does the board have?
Not much, but there is some. That's a good question. You can draft cease and desist letters if that booster group is using the board's name, the district's name, the logos, the motto or the mascot without authorization. You can, it's hard to do, but you can refuse the money that that booster group raised at the event that you didn't approve of.
But you
are limited. What you might want to start doing is having a representative involved in the booster groups. It's key that you board sending a representative isn't going to have somebody on the board of the booster organization.
So that's probably a good point to dive into. Sometimes boards think, well, we should have a board member or an administrator be somebody, one of like the head officers in the booster group, so that we can help kind of control and monitor what they're doing. But that's not always a good idea.
Yeah, that'd be too much of a conflict of interest. I mean, there's no law that prohibits that, but you really don't want a district administrator or board member serving as an officer.
Yeah, so just to clarify, Peter, you just said there's no law in Ohio that prohibits board members or administrators from being booster group officers. But a lot of our audience is from outside Ohio, so I just want to remind everybody that whenever we, you know, we're talking specifically about Ohio laws and regulations, and if you're not in Ohio, you as a district or a district employee should take care to research and review the laws and regulations in your own state, because you might have additional regulations relating to booster groups that we're not covering here.
That's true. Well, one requirement in Ohio specifically is that if you're a booster group and you raise over $25,000, then you have to register with the Ohio Attorney General's office.
Okay, that's a good point. Yeah, so other states might not have
that requirement.
Or have a different one.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens if something goes wrong, say a child is hurt at a booster event or sues the district?
Well, that could be problematic because the booster groups and their officers are not protected by Ohio's sovereign immunity laws.
So would the board's insurance policy kind of cover that defense or liability?
It depends. Oftentimes, the board's insurance policy does cover school support entities. So the district would want to check its policy to see if a booster group might be covered. If the booster group is covered and there's an additional charge, it's important that the district have the organization pay the additional charge for insurance coverage.
Does the district also have to allow all booster groups, or can they set any limits on these group activities?
I can imagine, you know, Peter, that sometimes a district is not going to want a particular booster group.
The district doesn't have to recognize all of them. So that's another reason why a Board of Education might want to adopt a resolution specifying which booster groups it's going to officially recognize. And some that aren't. Again, it may want to distance itself from certain booster groups that aren't engaged in activities that the board might approve of.
But really, they should try to be treating all these groups the same, right?
Right.
To avoid any type of discrimination or claims.
That's definitely the goal. Treat everybody the same. That's definitely the way to approach booster groups. But some booster groups have gone rogue. You see those headlines. So if you want to distance yourself, then you already recognize them. You board can actually withdraw your recognition, just pass a resolution and do it.
So along the lines of kind of like those rogue activities, are there certain things to keep in mind about like alcohol sales or gambling or some of those types of events?
Absolutely. First, if you want to serve alcohol at a fundraising event, you need the right permit. And there's a number of permits involved. It's a confusing area of the law, actually. So the booster group should seek out a legal counsel who's in the know regarding alcohol sales and nonprofit organizations and fundraisers. And gambling, too. There are laws involved. There's laws that govern bingo. So if there's a booster group that's trying to raise money by gambling, then they want to make sure that they're in tune with the law in Ohio.
And whatever state you're in.
And whatever
state.
You're
not in Ohio, yeah.
Right. In Ohio, laws charitable organizations to conduct gambling activities for fundraisers, but they have to be around for 2 years. So you can't just get your IRS letter and then open up a gambling hall.
Let's really dive into the fundraising aspect of it. That seems to be where a lot of the headlines come from of misuse of funds. Can you kind of walk us through that and how funds should be accounted for?
The best thing is to have some sort of structure when it comes to accounting for your funds. Ideally, the booster group would have multiple people looking at the books, multiple people reviewing how much money was raised, where that money's being deposited.
Okay.
Have a bank account in the name of the booster organization and not just one individual.
You know, I hear a lot about individual fundraising accounts. Can you explain what those are? And if they're legal?
They're very popular, but typically the way they're structured, they are illegal. And this is a more of a federal rule, too. So this would apply to every state, not just Ohio, because the guidance came from the IRS. And what they found is that there are a number of booster organizations and even schools that have individual fundraising accounts. So these are dedicated. They may not be bank accounts, but there is an organization that's keeping track of how much money a particular student raises, and then they would deduct how much money that student then has to put towards a certain activity, say for athletic equipment or uniforms if it's school band or to go on a trip, then the student may not have to pay as much because they raised X amount of dollars.
So what makes these illegal?
Yeah, I was just going to ask that. Why is this illegal?
Well, the IRS determined that the 501c3 designation and the tax benefits that come with it are supposed to be geared toward and to promote the entity and the organization as a whole and not individuals.
So kind of that charitable concept.
Yes. You can have a charity that just benefits one individual. And these individual fundraising accounts are essentially ways that only one individual benefits from the 501c3 designation.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
It's difficult. It's hard because there are those disincentives that may arise. And because if Johnny raises $500, mm-hmm. but Joey only raises $10, mm-hmm. it seems like Johnny should have a steeper discount when it comes to having to put money towards a new football equipment.
So how does this relate to non-participation fees? I feel like this maybe goes along with that. Can students be required to pay a fee if they don't want to fundraise?
There's some overlap with mm-hmm. the non-participation fees. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't be required to pay a fee if they don't fundraise for a particular fundraiser. The non-participation fees aren't outright illegal. They don't receive the same criticism from the IRS, but there are some things that you want to do if you do have non-participation fees. One is to set the same fee for all the fundraisers that will occur for the entire school year. And you don't want to prohibit a student from participating in certain activities just because they paid the fee. Again, you want to treat everybody the same. And if they're excused from the fundraiser, they get to participate in the student activities just as much as everybody else who did engage in fundraising.
Interesting. So do you have some kind of key points that our listeners can take away that they should keep in mind when dealing with these groups?
Well, booster groups really want to make sure that they have a number of checks and balances in place, mm-hmm. particularly when it comes to money. Make sure who is collecting the money, who is accounting for it, how is it being deposited.
Okay.
So you want multiple people involved there. Title IX is another big issue. You have booster groups sometimes that are designated to one particular sport. Oftentimes you'll hear of football boosters or baseball boosters, and they could raise exorbitant amounts of money for these activities. And then they want to donate hundreds of thousands of dollars to the district for the football program or the baseball program. Mm-hmm. The problem is Title IX requires that all of the students for both genders and both sexes, mm-hmm. male and female students, are treated equally. So if you have the baseball fundraisers receiving $200,000 for a new AstroTurf field, mm-hmm. but softball players only getting no benefit at all, they're just the same dirt field without the lights and without the grandstands, mm-hmm. then there is a risk of a Title IX violation.
If softball is considered a sport where there's more girls, is that what you're saying?
Softball, right. Okay. So that would be considered the girls' sport, and baseball is the male equivalent. The district, in order to avoid a Title IX violation, would either have to refuse the money or come up with the money themselves to counter whatever the boosters are giving to the boys' team, or work with that boys' booster group to ensure that the girls' softball team gets some of that money and some of the benefit.
That's interesting.
So really kind of allocating those funds
equally.
Otherwise, you'd have to refuse it.
Yeah. So
is that what schools do? Districts, do they refuse it?
I would say, in my experience, the schools typically work out an arrangement so that the girls also benefit from that money that's raised. Mm-hmm. I would say more and more schools have general athletic boosters mm-hmm. so that the money's donated not to a particular sport. Mm-hmm. Is it donated to the athletic department in general? Then the school has more control over how that money's going to be divvied up.
That sounds like the most simplistic way to do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like
easiest
maybe just have
to
it to it general yeah. versus this is a football booster and there's no girls football.
Yeah.
You know, I could see.
It really depends on the district. And some districts have a little bit more money in their budgets. So if the boys are getting $25,000 for a new scoreboard, they're able to also dedicate $25,000 to the girls.
Interesting.
So any other last tips to focus on before we wrap this up?
Not really. Boosters are great. I mean, don't take away from this conversation that boosters come with a lot of baggage and mm-hmm. you want to avoid them. I mean, they are great at generating money, and schools cash strapped. And so they need all kinds of different alternative ways to generate that money.
Especially for all these extracurricular activities
right.
yeah. districts are having to cut back on a lot.
Absolutely. So boosters are great. Utilize them. Just be careful when you're doing so.
Peter, thanks so much for joining us today. Next time, we will talk about something else that's interesting and relevant for school districts across the country.
If you have other ideas, feel free to email us with your topics.
And please subscribe to this podcast and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play Music, or wherever you get your podcast.
As always, thanks for listening.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
The content of this podcast is provided for general information purposes only. The podcast is not legal advice, does not create an attorney-client relationship, and should not be relied upon in making legal decisions. Actions on legal matters should be taken only upon advice of legal counsel. Walter Haverfield does not guarantee the accuracy of information contained in this podcast.